You're listening to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, 92.5 on your FM dial. Forgive me for my hoarse voice today. This is the Wild Clearwater Country Show. A quick weather update for all you Palouse residents out there. Tonight, chance of thunderstorms, low of 53. Also tomorrow, high of 85 and some more thunderstorms predicted down into the 40s Thursday night. And then we start heating back up, high of 80s on Friday, and then into the weekend getting into the mid-90s and lows in the mid-50s at night. Well, thanks for joining us. Like I said, forgive me for the frog in my throat, as the great Garbanzo would say. He'll be here. We have a fun-filled show for you like usual. A couple of announcements first. Friends of the Clearwater will be having a potluck August 29th, 6:30 p.m. For more information, directions to that potluck, going to be featuring a couple of folks from the South, from way down in Haiti. And, teaming up with our Music and Words, Nancy Casey. It should be a lot of fun, informative and fun, presentations and a cookout. The next two Wednesdays, the Palouse Audubon Society are hosting morning field trips to Phillips Farm to catch those last fall migrants passing through and also to hit a few ponds. If you're a birder, you know that fall is always good for shorebirds, and there's only a few scattered locations you can see them in the Moscow vicinity. And so if you'd like to catch a look at some of those long-legged, long-billed creatures and their little hideouts, please join Palouse Audubon, 7 a.m. next two Wednesdays, Rosar's parking lot, heading to Phillips Farm and a couple ponds around the county. There will be a town hall meeting. We're going to talk more about this, too. There will be a town hall meeting August 23rd. Larry Craig will be in town.
And he's going to be at the Best Western Silver Room, I guess, I believe, from 7 to 8.
That's
right. I guess he's looking for input from citizens. Am I registering there?
That's
well?
Right.
Looks like I am.
You are. Okay. Yeah, that is exactly right. Wide open. Wide open to comment about some things.
And just as a quick note here, September 27th, I believe, is the date that Senator Craig will be holding hearings on a couple of bills that will affect Idaho. One is the Owyhee Initiative, which designates some sort of wilderness. It has all these exceptions to the Wilderness Act, which I find personally unacceptable. But then it has all these weird land exchanges and other provisions in there which make it a much less than desirable bill. And also the Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act, which actually gives away public land and designating substandard wilderness as well. Another poorly conceived piece of legislation. But Senator Craig, I think, has expressed some concerns about the public land, either tradeaways or giveaways in those bills. So I think people want to say something to him in Moscow. There's an opportunity, and probably contact him later on.
Good opportunity. Take an hour of your evening.
Yeah.
Yeah, make the democratic process work how it's supposed to.
That's right.
And let's see, what else is happening this weekend, I believe, down in Kamiai all weekend, starting Friday at noon. There will be Chief Looking Glass celebration put on by the descendants of Chief Looking Glass.
That's right.
In his purse.
And it's open to the public.
That's right. Open to the public. There will be traditional friendship dinners. There will be a powwow, good time for all. And if you're interested in camping down there, folks are allowed to camp there right behind the Wyeth. Mm-hmm. Facility down there. There's plenty of places to get food in town. And, of course, the friendship dinners, I've been told, are great food and free to the public. And just a good chance to get to know some folks, your Nez Perce neighbors better, and meet some people and take part in a pretty important celebration.
All right.
All right, Cami. Well, that's about it for announcements, Gary.
I think that is. I think we've got a couple big topics. If you, we're going to be spotlighting some species, some interesting relationships between some plants and some members of the insect world. Mm-hmm. And that's going to segue us into kind of the major topic for this week. And if you look outside, you see clouds. And when you see clouds in the summertime, there's one thing it means, lightning. And
all right.
That means on the national forest, that means fire. And we'll talk a little bit and give an update on the fire issue in the wild Clearwater country.
Yeah, there are quite a few fires burning, even one called the Lightning Fire.
That
getting,
is right.
Getting closer and closer to Riggins by the hour, they say.
That's right.
Hopefully not too close. All right, so, well, anyway, Gary, I was telling you, I was talking to a couple friends this morning. We were out looking at different animals and plants, hiking around, and someone mentioned an interesting relationship that I was unaware of, and some species involved that I'm not too familiar with. And so I know that your background in range ecology, you talked about ceanothus quite a bit and how important it is for elk browse or for elk forage. And apparently tortoise shell butterflies are big fans of ceanothus.
Interesting.
Yeah, and these are some really beautiful lesser known species of the wild Clearwater country. I think insects probably elude most people. Most species elude most people. And interesting enough, there's been a trend in recent, maybe the last decade or so, those folks who are fanatic about watching birds, you know, calling themselves the birders, gotten interested in butterflies and dragonflies too. Even attached an ing to the end of those species names and calling them a hobby, butterflying and dragonflying. And there's been a proliferation of field guides that give us a better glimpse into the lives, especially the physical attributes of those insect species. And so we've dug around and found a little information about tortoise shell butterflies in Idaho, and we're going to share that with you and also talk a little bit more about this plant that they seem to have an interest in and seem to use to some extent, at least. And we do hope to have more information on this relationship in the future. As soon as we look into it, looking into the research, hopefully, maybe even there could be some research looking into whether or not decline in ceanothus due to suppression of fire has an impact on our six-legged friends too.
All right. Well.
Okay. Well, tortoise shells are in the family known as brush-footed butterflies. And for those of you who like your Latin, I had a plant taxonomy professor in college, Gary, who, he was a riot. He was just a warehouse of information, but he had this strange kind of stuttering that he did. And if you know, the most of these families' names end in A-E. Mm-hmm. And he would just kind of stop on that AE and spend some time there a little bit longer than you were supposed to. So if he were to say the family name of this group, which is the Nymphalidae, I'm having trouble saying it myself, he might stay on there and say the Nymphalidae. He would just get a little carried away. Uh-huh. But the Nymphalidae, for those of you who like your Latin, the brush-footed butterflies. And they're called that because the first pair of their legs are very small, and they're covered with brush-like scales, and they're not used for walking. They're rather small, and so they only walk on four legs, which most butterflies apparently walk on six. And another attribute of the brush foots, of which these tortoise shells are part of, is that they tend to fly in a zigzag pattern. The three brush foots found in the wild Clearwater country are the California brushfoot.
Seems like everything's named after California.
I tell you,
they get
really,
all the luck, don't they?
They really do. The California brushfoot, California tortoiseshell, Milbert's tortoiseshell, and the Compton tortoiseshell. And California tortoiseshell and the Milbert's tortoiseshell are found throughout the state. Compton's tortoiseshell appears to only be found throughout the northern panhandle, but species like this, insects especially, often get overlooked, and surveys aren't always accurate or haven't been performed in certain counties, and so you can't always trust that those maps. Some other interesting things about the tortoise shells is that they're beautifully patterned. Orange brown, large black spots on their upper wings, and tending to have rather drab underwings, as many butterflies do. And if you did not know, butterflies do have four wings. They have four wings and hind wings. The hind wings are typically much smaller and can be a little bit harder to notice. But if you look closely enough, you'll see that they do have four wings. And if we look at the habitat of these creatures, we'll note that they prefer chaparral, woodland, brushy areas, forest clearings, and edges. The California tortoise shell is found all the way from British Columbia, even across the U.S. and into the East Coast, and even down into Mexico. Not much conservation information is known about these species. They're listed as not of concern, but not much is known about their population nationwide or region-wide, for that matter. Just to give you a little information about their life history, they tend to perch on hillsides in the afternoon, logs or bushes. This is the males, to watch for females. And eggs are laid in large batches on the underside of host plant leaves, such as ceanothus, which are then fertilized. Young caterpillars feed together in the web, and while older ones feed alone and make shelters of folded leaves tied with silk. Interesting creature. And it seems that they tend to breed in the summer months into the fall, between May and October.
Wow, breeding into the fall.
Yeah.
And so I guess the eggs overwinter then.
Yeah.
And do the animals migrate, or do they just die? They live annually.
Let's see. They do migrate. They are migratory. They head far south, it seems.
Wow.
Yeah. It says that they breed in Mexico. And when they have population explosions, they're seen all over the United States, as opposed to typically they're found in the West. But after large population explosions in Mexico, they'll be seen on the eastern seaboard.
So somewhat like the monarch, somewhat migratory, very, very interesting.
Yeah.
So they must live more than a year. Very, wow.
They feed on sap, rotting fruit, and the nectar of willow flowers.
Oh.
And thistles, goldenrods, lilacs, lots of different food sources. Interesting.
And the key into ceanothus.
And the Milbert's tortoiseshell tends to prefer its host being nettle, urtica. It tends to lay its eggs on nettles. So interesting.
There we go.
Well, ceanothus, Gary. There's a few ceanothus species.
There's quite a few of them. They're a very, very interesting plant. Sort of an evergreen, though they're not an evergreen in the sense of a conifer tree. They tend to have green leaves throughout the year. And they don't drop their leaves like other deciduous plants, which they're part of the one would consider the deciduous families. There happen to be I'm not sure this means a lot to people, but a dicotyledon, two main branches of the flowering plants. And they're commonly known by other names. Some people call them snowbrush. Ceanothus is a name used around here. Buckbrush, I've heard, is a term, although that can be used, applied to other species. But down in California, they have a very specific name for all of them, and it's chaparral. And that's one of the very interesting things about this this genus, Ceanothus, is exactly the generic name. It starts with a C, Ceanothus is the generic name of genus. Many, many species around here in the wild Clearwater country. There are several species. The most important for elk forage is red-stem Ceanothus, but there are others as well. Two or three other species are not quite as well as good for forage. But being an evergreen or having leaves that remain green throughout the season is usually indicative of volatile oils in the leaf material. And that's why the California chaparral is so famous for burning with that intense but rapid heat in these brush fires. And they tend to do well, especially red-stem Ceanothus tends to do well after fire. And it can come in even many years after fire. Some of the interesting research being done on the Lolo National Forest, an area not all that different than the wild Clearwater country, just over the Bitterroot Divide, a little bit drier, but still a part of sort of this inland, somewhat wetter forest. You'll find cedars and a few places over on the Lolo. But they found in some of the big fires, I believe in 2000, and in 2003 were a couple big fire years in Montana and on the Lolo National Forest. They found that red-stem Ceanothus sprung up in areas that had been forested, in which fires had been excluded for almost 100 years, or that no fires had burned. But you got some of these big old forested stands that burned hot, and boom, red-stem Ceanothus came back. Very interesting. So the seeds that stay viable in the soil for many years, probably decades, and they do well after fire, and they're part of what we call a seral condition. And generally, they're not the climax species on a site. They're the ones you would expect to find there. But they're there because of disturbances like fire. When conifer trees or a forest may be the environment which you would expect to find there. So the fire and Ceanothus go hand in hand. And again, they can burn hot, and then they will resprout. They're quite vigorous resprouters. But they tend to lose their forage value after 10 years, and in particular, it declines significantly from 10 to 25 years. Fire being a very common visitor to the Clearwater, we'll talk a little bit about that more later. Well, is key to where you find most Ceanothus, and they're part of what we call the persistent, in some places, persistent brush fields. I don't know how persistent they are, because these areas that probably at one time, at least in the last 500 to 1,000 years, were forested. But especially in the Locksaw, Selway, North Fork, especially around the North Fork around Cook Mountain, there's been some research done on some of these brush fields. And they've noted that some of the fires, they've speculated that some of the fires there date back to the 1600s, and they think that their Ceanothus have been at least a component of that vegetation in those areas for about 400 years. So it's, again, a fire-loving plant, comes in after the fires. Once plant succession takes place, then it tends to go out of the system in some places, like on the Lolo, completely out. But then the big fires, hot fires come again, which they do periodically here in the Clearwater country. We have both low-intensity and high-intensity fires here. Actually, most of the forested country, it tends to be a system used to more high-intensity fires. It really likes that kind of a disturbance and then pops up again. And you look at a lot of those south-facing slopes. If anyone drives up Highway 12 in the Locksaw around Fish Creek, you'll see all those big open areas. A lot of that is Ceanothus, but there's also bitter cherry, choke cherry, service berry, and Rocky Mountain Maple, or other associates with Ceanothus, and they all tend to do well after fire. But particularly Ceanothus is well adapted, giving the hard seed cases that they need that fire to germinate. And the plants themselves, with their volatile oils, tend to help fire along in the leaf material itself. And in important, like I say, some species more important than others, not necessarily good, but a lot of the forage plants, especially in wintertime, for ungulates like deer and elk, tend to have volatile oils in them. And, you know, the dry shrub steppes, more indicative of further south in Idaho and in the Great Basin, plants like bitterbrush, mountain mahogany, and, of course, sagebrushes all have volatile oils in them. And if you've ever chewed on those leaves, you'll notice how nasty they are. But the elk and the deer seem to like them just fine, although some of them, once in the, even if the concentrations are too high, even deer and elk sort of, I think, would turn up their nose at them. But that's sort of a little bit about Ceanothus, a rather interesting and important forage plant, big brushy plant. And I'll just say one last thing. When you're out in the field, one of the very indicative ways you can tell Ceanothus is you look at those leaves. They're kind of those rounded, you know, kind of leaves, a couple inches long maybe, oval in shape, not perfectly round, but more oval. But you'll notice on the back three very distinct veins that are somewhat, it looks kind of like those little tridents, those pitchforks. But there's three very distinct veins and then little ones branching off that. And that's a good way to get down to at least the genus Ceanothus, is when you see that, you're almost certain that that's what you're looking at. Plants, usually we key them by their flowering characteristics. But this is one where you can tell at least this genus by its vegetative characteristics, those veins.
All right. Thanks, Gary. And just to clarify a little bit of what I mentioned earlier, wild lilac being a host. That's a common term some folks have used for Ceanothus. And so the California tortoiseshell does prefer to use the Ceanothus plants as its host plant and feeds on flower nectar.
Oh, wild lilac. So, that is an interesting term. I never realized.
Yeah.
But when you look at the flowers, yes. They are the same. Of course, our lilacs are rather tamed versions of it, but interesting.
Yeah.
There we go. Don't know much about domesticated plants other than the ones I like to eat.
Yeah.
And, that's
exactly.
Something new. We learn something new all the time.
Well, I think we're going to go into a little music here.
All right.
A little Amy Martin song about ravens.
Okay.
Stay with us.
I went walking on the mountain. Hoping to find a path leading up and out of my troubled mind. Too distracted for discussion, too tired to say a prayer, just grateful to put my foot down and find a solid ground there. I wanna let my I'm gonna get me a pair of rings. Let my heart just sing. Someday I'm gonna get me a pair of raven's wings.
Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. Well, we're starting to talk about fire a little bit there, Gary. I can't help but tell. I was thinking about when you started talking about some of those volatile oils in ceanothus. I couldn't help but think about how well seasoned that elk meat probably already is. You probably don't have to add a thing to it, you know.
No.
Especially they've been eating sage. Ooh.
Ooh, boy, yeah. Man. That stuff is those volatile oils. Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, that gets us into our next topic. We'll just kind of burn right along into it. Over to
right.
The fire.
Yeah.
What a year. It's been...
It's getting there.
It's getting there. We're finally seeing some fire activity. And fire is a very natural and crucial part of the Wild Clearwater Country. It's what shapes the vegetation and the landscape. Perhaps the most important influence on the vegetation in this part of the world. Natural fires, lightning-caused fires, have always been a part of the Clearwater Country, at least probably in human history and almost in geologic time, Will. Fire frequency depends on weather patterns with lightning, and it's been a rather common element, and it's been part of the Clearwater Country at least since the retreat of the glaciers. Although there have been some fairly dramatic changes in vegetation, we do know about around 6,000 years ago, it was probably a bit drier and warmer, and kind of a trend that we're seeing right now through global warming. And some of the archaeological evidence indicates that while there were stands of cedars in some of these bottoms, these cedar groves that have been able to hang on for a long time, and our relic populations, a lot of the break country, places that we see the shrubs today, some people think that, it wasn't that long ago that some of that country was a high, even sagebrush may have been a component one time in part of the Clearwater Country, which we don't really see much sage today, only if we get down the lower end on the private lands around Lewiston and places like that, you run into it. It's not a particularly common element in the Clearwater Basin, being a little bit wetter than that. But some of the archaeological evidence shows that they had higher numbers of different ungulate species, which are not very common at all in the Clearwater anymore. For example, bighorn sheep, although there were some here historically, a little bit too forested now, and perhaps historically for that species. Again, 6,000 years ago, it tended to be much more rather common, and also indications there were bison in the Clearwater country 6,000 years ago. So, very interesting. Very interesting feature of the landscape fire. Well, this year has been fairly active, but it's what the Forest Service termed to us, Will, kind of a normal fire year. Had a lot of lightning strikes here in August, and they've probably jumped far too many fires. They've tried to put out some that weren't a problem. I just downloaded their fire activity for the Clearwater and the Nez Perce National Forest. And to kind of give you an idea, of the first 20 fires that we see on here, two of them, it looks like, are still active. And these are fires that were started, most of them by lightning, some were human-caused. One instance were of this list of 20. And this is starting at the beginning of the year, and this is on the Clearwater Forest. And so the first fire started actually in June. Yeah, a little bit of lightning activity. And, of course, they probably didn't do much, and I'm not sure that these fires, we'll have to find out a little more detail. It doesn't look like they did anything, a tenth of an acre and a 2/10 of an acre were the size of the couple of those in June. But one that started in early July called Bar Creek up on Pot Mountain, it's about 1,300 acres now, and it's one that they call wildland fire use. They're allowing fire in this instance to play its role. There's another in about 38 acres also on the Clearwater National Forest up near on the Powell District that is they're trying to, I think, put out, but it has been going now for since the late July, and of course it's a lightning caused fire. But most of the fires have been put out. I mean, look at the next 30 or so fires. There's a few of them that are still burning. There's a few more a little bit later on, the ones that were started. You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 active of about the next 30. One of those, Hanson Meadows, they're allowing to burn. One called Copper Creek, also up in that part of the world. Kelly Creek Roadless Country is being allowed to burn. And some warm springs and hot springs down in the Salway Bitterroot Wilderness being allowed to burn. But when you look at it, not a particularly active year right now. Those fires are allowing to burn are a tenth. They say they're only a tenth of an acre right now, with the exception of the one in Hanson Meadows, which is up to about 20 acres. And so that's the one that may actually do a little bit of good. They're above Hanson Meadow there in Kelly Creek. It's a neat area, wolves and whatnot in the country. And then a little further west, up in the Moose Buttes, the Moose Mountain roadless area, there's a 105-acre fire. Again, they're allowing that to burn in Slide Creek, create a little more elk food. And there are a couple others up in that part of the world. I would guess these are probably on the Loxaw District that they're allowing to burn. But again, very tiny, tiny fires, tenth of an acre. Then you get down to the Nez Perce National Forest, getting, again, a little bit drier, but still in the Clearwater Country. Just a touch drier, though. Not as many cedars you find. In fact, when you get in the Red River Country of the South Fork, you don't find cedars at all. You do find them on the American River portion of the South Fork Clearwater, kind of an interesting divide there. You look at what's active there, it's very similar. There's almost nothing that's active. They had a couple fires that they let go in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness that were started back in the first part of July. Apparently those have burned out now. And a lot of these fires, they probably didn't need to do anything to them. They've got one that started apparently in the 6th of July back in the wilderness. And it's still a tenth of an acre. So it's just maybe just been smoldering around, at least according to the Forest Service statistics. It's only a tenth of an acre. And it's just probably kind of smoldering around there, you know, doing whatever could be doing. And actually they had a fire in some of the roadless country up by Johns Creek, and apparently I think they, unfortunately, I think they tried to put that one out. It's no longer burning. It got up to about 26 acres. They had one up in Nut Basin, also down that part of the world, Nut Basin. I believe that's over, that's a little closer to the Slate Creek country. That's up in Slate Creek. That got pretty big. Apparently, they put that one out, 270 acres. They didn't want that one to go. And but they have some other ones like that they are allowing to burn. Shining Buttes up to 50 acres. And Cub Creek up in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness up to 5 acres. Not a lot of these aren't very big, you know, in the Frying Pan, 15 acres. But some of them in the Selway Bitterroot are starting to burn. It looks like they've got one here up to about 230 acres now. So that's the kind of fire year they expect. The Forest Service expects to continue to have some lightning. Unlike some of the rest of the country, though, and this is why the Forest Service, in part, doesn't allow more fires to burn. And it really is a tragedy. And that is, fires tend to start here in late July, August, with these thunderstorms. The Clearwater is wet enough that fires really except in rare instances, and we mentioned some of those that actually started in June, they probably went out on their own. They probably didn't even need to get up to fight them. Most fires don't really get started or are not detected until late July, August, and even into September. This is a fire season here. In other places in the West, this time of year, people are very frightened of fires because they can get huge and big, and therefore the Forest Service has more of the mindset, well, we got to put them all out. Yet this is about the only time they can actually burn in this part of the world, and that's in part why the Clearwater has been such a fire-shaped landscape by big hot fires, is that you get the right conditions in the right year. And then you have just a dry July, and you get something roaring in July, toward the end of July, and go through August, September, maybe even into October, depending on the right condition. And fires like happened in 1910, 1934, probably will repeat themselves at some point in time. That's part of what shapes the Clearwater Country here. So we're looking at fires, and it's amazing. Clearwater, as of right now, has had about 52 fires. Most of those probably went out on their own, although they probably put out far too many. Nez Perce National Forest looks like they have had a lot more strikes. They tend to be a little more active, a little further south. They tend to be really in that fire zone. And they also are a larger national forest. That's the other thing to remember. They actually cover a larger swath of land, but they've had 105 fires, apparently, that they've recorded this year. And again, the vast majority of those have been lightning caused, and there's some of them that, in fact, the one called Lightning. Yeah, it's very active down there, and I don't even know that they've intended to let that go, but it's at 1,200 acres already, so there you go.
Yeah, and we're just getting into that time where the Forest Service is going to be doing their planned fires, mm-hmm. starting fires of their own.
That's right.
Just passed that date.
Just passed that date, and they're starting. And they may not have to do a lot this year because it's been quite active. We've had these thunderstorms build up. Some years you don't get lightning strikes. It's very dry, and we may see more of that, more drying trends. So fire behavior, we may see less and less of the kind of piddling fires like we're seeing this year. This is kind of an anomaly, and more of the bigger fires when you have the right conditions for lightning strikes. Because if we have a seasonal dry times, as many of the models predict for the Clearwater Country, we're probably going to be seeing less thunderstorm activity in the late summer. And so when fires do get going by lightning, then they may really have an opportunity to burn.
We sure have seen more thunderstorms around here than the past couple summers this year.
Yeah, this year, that's why I say it's an interesting good fire year. It's more like, I think this year is probably a more typical of what historically has been the kind of thunderstorm activity that we've had. When you look back through, since people have been recording fire activity in the Clearwater since probably about 100 years now, maybe a little over, but around 100 years in some detail, maybe a little less. This is more typical of the early half of the 1900s up to maybe about the 1970s. And we started seeing some fairly major changes, I think, in the 80s and 90s in terms of climate, and the fires tend to be bigger and hotter, and I think there's no question the research is now showing it seems to indicate, rather than fire suppression, what the Forest Service has always blamed in recent years, it is the global climate change on fire behavior. And we will, when you have drier conditions, you tend to have hotter fires if you have the fuel for them to burn. And fuel amount doesn't seem to be the main determinant of fire severity. It tends to be climate.
Right.
So...
Yeah,
again, the research is showing that.
Yeah, and some new reports are coming out and are confirming that.
Right.
And Now, how big is that Bar Creek fire, Gary?
That's about 1,300, 1,400 acres now, and it's a really interesting one. It hasn't I got the opportunity to fly over that about, a month ago, I guess it's been now. That's about right. About a month ago, and it wasn't doing a whole lot then, maybe 3 weeks ago, a month ago, and it wasn't particularly active, but it was kind of piddling around. It was when we had one of those hot streaks, we were kind of worried that we were going to have a terrible hot summer, and it was hot back in July. We had some really hot temperatures, and usually we've typically had warmer temperatures here in August, in the Palouse and the Clearwater Country, although not always, but we had some real barn burners there. I remember that part of July, and everybody was becoming very worried. But I flew over that, and it didn't seem to be particularly active. I couldn't actually see any flames. We saw the smoke, but we couldn't see any flames. But it's now up to about 1,300 acres. I think they put a fire line to prevent it from burning to the north, and they've sort of, quote, herded it, although I don't think it would have gone much in that direction anyway. They're kind of hurting it, and it's up to 1,300 acres, and it's burning in the Pot Mountain roadless mm-hmm. area, right where the Forest Service had some decisions, made a decision a couple, 3 years ago in the Middle Black environmental impact statement and record of decision to do some burning in that part of the world. So I don't know if it's burning exactly in the spot that they had intended to burn, but it's within, you know, that area. So they're pretty excited in letting that one go and hoping that it does something. They've had, I think they had a few other strikes in the Pot Mountain area, and they were hoping that those would actually do something, and I don't think they've, you know, a lot of years, the fires, you know, you get, just because you get a lightning strike does not mean you're going to have a fire, and as the district ranger described to me earlier on the phone today, there's a whole lot of rocks and just a handful of trees in that part. So under those conditions, you don't see a lot of burning. And that's, again, what happens naturally.
Yeah.
Sometimes fires grow and sometimes they don't. And this year, of course, we'll never know on these fires how big they might have gotten on the ones that the Forest Service decided to jump on immediately. But a lot of them may not have done much this year. There's just a few of them that seem to be getting big. And Bar Creek, again, it had an early history. One kind of freak started in 6th of July, I guess, or at least that's when they detected it. You know, just a little bit of thunder activity, probably a little bit of lightning. I remember that period of time being pretty dry. It might have been sort of the end of the rainstorms we had.
I remember lightning strikes on the 4th of July.
Yeah,
at
so
night.
At yeah. night. So maybe that would have been just toward the end of that period of rain, kind of that wetter period that we had, fairly wet June. And it didn't do much at first because, you know, again, the wetter conditions. Clear water tends to have a lot of spring moisture. And so it hadn't dried out yet. But now it's up to 1,300 acres, and it's it tends not to be moving fast, and that's typical. And we'll see what happens. This kind of weather, the temperatures, again, the climate, probably not conducive to the huge fire years like 1910 or 1934 or even 1994 or 2000, which had some pretty extreme, 2003, some pretty amazing and important fire behavior. So this year, again, more of a normal year. Although a lot of strikes, conditions aren't probably great for a lot of burning.
Yeah, fire is interesting. You know, last week we were talking with James about his time as a firefighter, getting a little firsthand accounts of what it's like down there and what firefighters are doing. And this week we're talking more about the wild Clearwater Country and the fires currently. And I've been reading some reports recently that sometimes in some years the Forest Service will spend, you know, upwards of half its budget on fire suppression and fire-related efforts. And I read an article in the paper the other day that said basically that the nation's firefighters in the West are spread so thin that they're importing firefighters from New Zealand and Australia to battle fires. And mm-hmm. I wonder how much that cost.
Oh, that's a huge cost, and there's sort of an open check. And I don't know that there's anything that people can really do about it, short of trying to protect their homes in and around the area. The research, again, by Dr. Cohen, a Forest Service researcher out of Missoula, indicates that the best thing you can do for your place is to clear the flammable materials away, get a metal roof. And, yeah, right near your house, you might want to take out some trees and you want to have things that don't burn. Well, keep that yard clean and free of flammable material, and that's the way you save your structure. There isn't a whole lot you can do out in the backcountry. And, in fact, doing much beyond about 40 meters really doesn't do much for structure protection. People don't realize that. It really doesn't do much for structure protection now. Big fires are going to happen. We live in a fire-prone system, just as people that live on the Gulf Coast live in a hurricane-prone system. So that's what happens, and people, I think, have to recognize that and can't always expect the government to always bail them out, or, I think even worse, expect the government to so radically alter the ecology of an area so that fires no longer burn. I think that's foolish, and whether it can be done, that's questionable. But it certainly, in my mind, ought not to be done because of the cost and cost to do this in terms of dollars and also human lives. We learned of a tragedy on the Payette just recently. Apparently, a helicopter went down, killing the pilot and three Forest Service employees. And again, it wasn't. It wasn't a fire-related death. They went out there actually fighting the fire, and then they got burned up or something. This is, and generally, deaths related to firefighting are these not right on the lines, being actually killed by a fire per se, but other things. Older Forest Service employees, heart attacks. Because fighting fire is very hard and hot, and can really put a lot of stress on the heart. Those are some of the things that do happen. So. I think we need to rethink fire policy, and people need to take some responsibility for their homes, and that we need to concentrate just right around sites, and that would be a much saner and more economical and more ecologically sound policy than trying to spend millions of dollars fighting these fires that do a lot of good and help shape that landscape and contribute to the diversity of our national forest.
Yeah, that's good, Gary. I like your analogy of hurricanes to fire, and we really need to start actively, as a nation, federal government, to suppress hurricanes. I think.
Yeah.
We should funnel millions of dollars into suppressing hurricanes. I think some of these ill-conceived wilderness bills bring up a good point here too. Is that some of these public land giveaways are going to be causing some more of these problems.
Exactly. Whenever we give away land inside, a national forest, in which the Central Idaho Economic Development and Recreation Act does, you're creating problems for fire policy. One of the reasons the Powell Ranger District feels it has to suppress many of the fires, including some in the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. And one last year was a particular tragedy. They went in and they clear cut inside the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness, 2-acre or 3-acre landing pad for a helicopter, which wasn't needed. And the district ranger, rightly so, got a little bit of hot water over that, and that should never have happened. And that was unnecessary and unneeded. It was because 20 miles away, there's some private land at the checkerboard inholding that was just recently purchased from Plum Creek and changed hands, and now is owned by a real estate / timber baron, self-made man. I think he considers himself Tim Blixeth. And he wants to trade that away. It would be good to obtain that in national forest ownership. Then that would allow much of that upper Loxaw country for natural fires to burn. Of course, it also must be remembered that there were many fires up there that were not natural, that were started when Plum Creek was actively logging the area. And some of the biggest fires in the upper Lauksaw were actually human caused rather than lightning caused. And in clear cut areas, when there's slash on the ground, that tends to burn really big and fast and hot through those areas because you've got the dry fuels on the ground, and they just, in some places, when we flew over the Beaver Creek fire of 2003, the forests, the national forest, didn't burn, but all these clear cuts did. And you can see these big black squares of clear cut land versus the green squares of the national forest. So, again, land giveaways and having public land in contiguous blocks is important to allow fire to play its ecological role. Whenever you have all these mixed land ownership patterns, you get into a whole bunch of jurisdictional problems that you mentioned, Will. Yeah, maybe we ought to use nuclear weapons to stop hurricanes.
Blow them up. That's right.
Just think of the
giant
disaster
fans,
that would create.
Blow them the other way.
Yeah, giant fans. Who knows?
Well, this is an interesting topic, Gary. I'm hoping we can talk more about fire a little bit next week. I think
it's a very important one, and we probably ought to touch on it and have give an update on some of the fires in the wild Clearwater country, including one that just one last brief mention before we get into the music that they put out in an area they were going to be lighting a fire here. Just ridiculous. So anyway, down on the Nez Perce Forest in the Cove area.
The Cove,
yeah, down there near Cove Mallard. That's right. Just down there, actually just on the other side of the road there, down just northwest of Mackey Bar.
Well, we're going to jump into a little music here. Some music Gary's bringing to us. Gary, if you want to introduce this.
Oh, it's a little bit of Dick Dale. I got to see Dick Dale. I got a free ticket. But Sandpoint here, or Spokane, Sandpoint. I get those two towns mixed up, even though they're very different. A while back, and a couple weekends ago, great surf guitarist. You know, he's kind of a godfather to a lot of the independent alternative rockers. So here you go, Dick Dale.
Bush, and when me and my men are on a clandestine mission in the Palouse, we do not listen to KRFP Moscow 92.5 FM, because Radio Free Moscow is an all-volunteer, community-based radio station that respects the First Amendment and brings you news and music you need to make informed dissent. That is not my idea of freedom.